We're happy to welcome Gert Bai from University of Hong Kong to give the Quantum Information Seminar today. And so there'll be a point in the middle of the talk where it'll be good to pause for questions. So save your questions till then, unless it's urgent. Thank you. Take it away.
Okay. Thank you. So may I start? Okay. I'm very happy to give this talk here, and good morning, everyone. I'm Gebai from the Quantum Information and Computation Initiative in the University of Hong Kong. And today, I'm going to talk about two topics, efficient data compression and causal order discovery, both for multi-parted quantum systems. I'll first talk about data compression, and there will be a pause after this part. And you can ask questions there. Quantum memories are essential for both quantum computation and communication. Classically hard problems can be solved efficiently on quantum computers. This is called quantum supremacy. Last year, Google has shown quantum supremacy with 54 qubits. And very recently, people from the USTC has also shown, again, quantum supremacy with a 100-mode optical interferometer. To solve harder problems, we need more memory. For example, it's estimated that to crack the 2048-bit RSA requires about 20 million qubits. Quantum memories are very useful, but at the same time, expensive. Since data are encoded in microscopic particles, they're prone to errors and they must be handled with extreme care. To reduce the cost of quantum memory, the most direct way is to use less memory. And that brings us to the topic of quantum data compression. Data compression aims to find the minimal size of memory to carry the information. It saves memory for quantum computers so that we can have more computing power. Also, it saves bandwidth for exchanging data, so we have more efficient quantum communication networks. The study of quantum data compression began with Schumacher in 1993, where a sequence of pure states were studied. And this was then extended to mixed states. Formally, quantum data compression involves a state family. A state family is a set of parameterized states, rho x, where x is a parameter. This is a subset of all the states on the Hilbert space HP, denoted as SHP. A compression protocol consists of two quantum channels, the encoder, which goes from the physical system HP to the memory HM, and the decoder, D, that goes from the memory HM to HP. These channels must satisfy the following condition: that for each rho x in the state family, we apply the encoder and then the decoder, it will recover the original state rho x. The memory size of the protocol is the size of the memory system, and this is log dim HM qubits rounded up. And for optimal data compression, this should be minimized. Here are our results. Previously, there have been studies on the special cases of independent identically prepared states, or IIP states. These are states in the form of rho x tensor n, meaning n identical copies of the state rho x. And our first result is to solve the most general case, and we have the optimal compression of IIP states. We show that these states can be encoded in a hybrid classical quantum memory. For each free parameter, we use about a half log n bits or qubits. We further showed that the fraction of the quantum memory can be arbitrarily small, but non-zero. In this talk, I'm not going into the details of this result, and I'm going to talk a more recent result of us that is going from the independent case to the correlated case. The motivation is that real data are structured. For example, in an image, adjacent pixels usually have similar colors. The same observation is true in physical systems. Particles that are geometrically closer are usually more correlated. These correlations give a certain structure of the quantum states on the systems, and this structure could help us to compress the states. How do we model this structure? We use tensor networks. Tensor networks are a compact way to express multi-party quantum systems. They use a graph, and the connections in the graph could be used to characterize the correlation in the systems. And for some structures, tensor networks would allow efficient numerical simulation of the states. Tensor networks cover a large category of locally correlated states, including the cluster states, matrix product states, etc. In this talk, I'm going to focus mainly on MPS, or matrix product states. Here are our notations for tensor networks. A tensor network is a directed graph, G equals to VE, such that each edge is assigned a DE dimensional Hilbert space, and each vertex is assigned a tensor. For vectors and operators, we use a box to represent each tensor. And a vector is a box with one edge. A cat is a box with one outgoing edge, and a bra is one with an ingoing edge. An operator has two edges. One is ingoing, and the other one is outgoing. When we connect those boxes together, we form a tensor network. Connecting those edges means to sum over the corresponding index. And the open edges in the final network corresponds to the open indices in the final result of multiplication. And by this, we can express the multiplication between operators and vectors. And for higher order tensors, we just need to use a box with more arrows attached to it, just like the example in the bottom right corner. So we are, as I mentioned before, we are going to focus on matrix product states, or MPS. MPS is a model of locally correlated states. It includes, for example, the AKLT model and the one-dimensional easing model. We'll consider mainly a site-independent MPS, or SIMS, with open boundary conditions. These states are specified by, first, n physical systems, each of dimension dp, a correlation system with dimension dc, where dc is called the bound dimension, a set of dc times dc matrices, ai, where I goes from 1 to dp, two vectors L and R called the boundary conditions. And the expression for a SIMS is given in this equation. Here, ket I1, I2 to IN is the basis of the n-partied system, and the coefficient before it has a matrix product form, and thus it is called a matrix product state. Let's see how this MPS is put into a tensor network. To show this, we need to regard the set of DC times DC matrices as one order three tensor. This can be done by putting those matrices together to form the entries of that tensor. And with this, we can write an MPS as a figure shown in the as a tensor network shown in the figure. In this figure, the vertical arrows denotes the physical systems, and these are open edges. And the horizontal arrows are the correlation systems. For data compression, we need to consider a state family other than one single state. So we define a tensor network with both variable and constant tensors. In this network, the variable tensors are those that depend on the parameter Vx, and the constant tensors are those are constant. We can always regard all variable tensors as one vector by putting all the entries in a long one long vector, and all constant tensors as a linear operator n, and write the state psi x equals to n times vx. In principle, to compute the optimal memory size for compression is not hard because we can always map the settled states into a space HM such that the dimension of HM equals to the dimension of the linear span of the settled states. This can be also bounded by the rank of the operator N. This provides the optimal memory size for exact compression of this state family. However, directly computing this linear span or the rank of N is infeasible because this would involve operations of exponentially large vectors and matrices. The way out is to use the tensor network structure. And now I'm going to show how we can use the tensor network structure to estimate the optimal memory size and to build efficient compression protocols. Our methods were based on the information flow in tensor networks. Imagine the information is flowing in the tensor network like a fluid from the source of parameters or variable tensors to the sink of output physical systems. Each edge has a capacity, and we define the capacity of an edge as CE equals log DE, where DE is a dimension. This is in the sense that DE dimensional Hilbert space can carry at most log DE qubits of information. A flow in this network assigns the number FE to each edge, such that this number is between 0 and CE, and that for each vertex, the flow is conserved, meaning that the sum of flow going in equals to the sum of flow going out. Let's see this example, the figure here. In the figure, the left-hand side is an information source and the right-hand side is an information sink. Each edge has two numbers. The blue one is a flow on that edge and the purple one is a capacity. The value of the flow in this network is defined as a total flow leaving the source. And in this example, it's log 3 plus log 4. The flow of a network is closely related to the cut of the network. A cut is a bipartition of the network such that the source and sink are on different sides. The capacity of a cut is the sum of capacities of edges crossing the cut. So, we can imagine the cut is a cross-section of that network, and the minimum cut is the thinnest cross-section, and we can call this the bottleneck of the network. And the information flowing in this network is bottlenecked by this minimum cut. So we have the minimum capacity of cuts is an upper bound of the maximum value of flows. In fact, these two numbers are the same due to the max flow min cut theorem. Again, let's see the example. In this example, the dashed line indicates the minimum cut of this network. And the capacity of this cut is log 3 plus log 4, which is equal to the value of the flow, as shown in the last page. Now, how are these helpful for compression? I mentioned before that the direct computation of the memory size is hard because we need to manage exponentially large vectors and matrices. However, computing the minimum cut of the network is easy. You can think the optimal memory size to encode the states is approximately the flow of information from the parameters to the systems. And this flow of information is further bounded by the minimum cut of the network. With this idea, we're going to prove our theorem that for a tensor network family, the optimal memory size is bounded by the minimum cut. Let's understand this theorem with an example. The example would be SIMS. We consider a general n-parted SIMS where all tensors are variable, including the tensors L, A, and R. We consider using theorem one and draw a cut between the variable tensors and the physical systems. This is the min cut of this network. It has capacity n times log dp. This is not actually a compression because n log dp is actually the original size of the system if you encode them into qubits. So to show a compression, we need to transform this network. The observation is that there are n repetitions of the same tensor n, A. And after transformation, we have this new network. In this new network, the I and the VS are the constant tensors. L, R, and SA are variable tensors. SA is a vector that has a polynomial dimension in N. SA is related to A by using the symmetric properties of the N repetitions of A. And for this new network, we can draw the minimum cut as follows. This minimum cut has capacity d squared dp log n plus 2 log dc. In this time, the capacity is only logarithmic in n. And thus, we can conclude that using our theorem, this family of sim states can be compressed into this number of qubits. We have shown that we can encode the n-parties NP sims to NO log n qubits. This is a generalization of our previous result of the IIP case, where we didn't allow entanglement there, but here we allow entanglement. Similar to the IIP case, we are going from O n qubits to O log n qubits, and we have an exponential memory reduction. Additionally, our result rediscovers the holographic compression, which states the follows: the memory to encode locally interacting particles in the region of a lattice is proportional to the parameter of that region. This can be seen directly from our theorem because the parameter is just a minimum cut. For a 2D lattice, we are going from O n squared qubits to O n qubits, and thus we have a quadratic memory reduction. We have talked about how to estimate the memory size, and now let's talk about how to implement the compression protocol. We propose an efficient compression algorithm based on quantum machine learning and tensor networks. Our algorithm achieves optimal compression and runs on a quantum computer in polynomial in n time for any MPS family that is compressible with O log n qubits. For the general case, for the more general case other than MPS, we give a set of sufficient conditions for our algorithm to run efficiently. To summarize, since quantum memory is expensive, we consider compression of memory, which minimizes the use of memory. First, we propose an efficiently computable memory bounds. This is based on the intuition that real data are structured. We model the structure of quantum data as a network, and we proved that the optimal memory size is bounded by the minimum cut of the network. Second, we propose an efficient compression algorithm that reaches the optimum memory size and runs in polynomial time for MPS families. Here are some future directions of this work. First, we can go from exact compression to approximate compression. In practice, there will always be errors and noise, and thus we should always consider the approximate case. And another motivation of approximate compression is that for IIP states, it is observed that allowing a small error saves a lot of memory. We want to see whether this is still true for correlated states. Another future direction is to go from state compression to gate compression. Gate compression is depicted in this figure. We have a multi-parted gate UX, and we want to map it to another smaller state, UX prime, with some encoder, decoder, and an auxiliary system. This is important for cloud computing because this could reduce the transmission cost between the client and the server. The problem of gate compression has been solved for the IIP unitary gates in the form of U tensor N. However, in the more general case, correlated multiparty gates, we do not have a solution yet. We expect to do this later with still tensor networks and machine learning, just as what we do with the states. Okay, that's all for the compression part. And let me pause here and questions are welcome. Is there any questions?
So actually, I have a question. So are you going to explain how you would do this compression, or you just, yeah?
You mean this algorithm?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was not going into details because the time limitation. And I say this is actually based on the work of quantum, the universal quantum emulator. We're using machine learning algorithms. Like we are going to sample, well, it's hard to explain in a few sentences. It's like we are going to give the learning machine samples of samples of states before compression and after compression. Mm-hmm. And we let the learning machine to learn this map.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is the idea.
I see. So then runtime is poly in N, I see.
Okay. Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, are there any other questions?
Maybe another one just about the algorithm. So when you say there's the machine learning, is it like a quantum machine learning algorithm, or is it like classical machine learning coupled to a quantum?
The quantum one.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. If there are no other questions, I'm going to continue. Is that all right? Okay, then I'm going to continue. Next, I'm going to talk about the second topic, quantum causal order discovery. In a quantum network, data are not transmitted directly. They are transmitted via multiple intermediate nodes, including repeaters and routers. In realistic cases, the availability of these nodes may be changing due to the environment or the network traffic, and this will lead to the change of the network structure. So to manage the network and to find the optimal data transmission paths, we need to know which paths are accessible in this network. And we put this problem to the problem of discovery of causal order. More generally, we may consider a quantum system is going through some events. Each event could be an operation or an observation. These events have a causal order in the sense that if operation A is before observation B, then A may affect the result of B. In turn, if operation A is after observation B, then A must not affect B because something in the future cannot affect the past. The problem of causal order discovery is that given access to the operations and observations decides the order of the events. And from this, we can infer the path of the particle. we model the quantum causal structure with a quantum comb. This is the general structure for any causally ordered quantum process. A quantum comb is a channel that can be decomposed into n subchannels, where each subchannel is called a tooth of the comb. As in this figure, each subchannel has an input wire labeled with A1 to AN and an output wire labeled with B1 to BN. These subchannels are connected together with memory wires. The quantum comb defines a causal order. AI only affects the outputs after it. That means BJ with I no larger than J. Well, if C has this structure, we will write C belongs to COM A1B1 to ANBN. And we'll say C is compatible with this causal order. To put the causal order discovery problem into the language of quantum comms, we formulate the problem as follows. We're given black box access to the channel C with an inputs and an outputs. The goal is to determine which causal structure it is compatible with. The possibilities of causal structures may be a lot. It could be at most n factorial squared, because we can permute all the n inputs and all the n outputs. Here is an example with n equals to 2, and there are four possibilities. More formally, we are given black box access to a quantum channel with n input wires and n output wires. We know that this channel had some causal order that is specified by the permutations sigma prime and pi prime. Sigma prime and pi prime are unknown to us. And our goal is to produce permutations sigma and pi such as C is equal or approximately equal to a quantum comb D compatible with the causal order specified by sigma and pi. And we do not require sigma pi and sigma prime pi prime to be the same because one quantum comb could be compatible with multiple causal orders.
Excuse me, may I ask a quick question? Is it an assumption that such a channel has this comb structure?
Yeah, the assumption is the channel had this structure, but we do not know the order of the inputs and outputs.
How is it generic? Like, if I'm given quantum channel, like, is it even like some network, and then is it something very normal to have well-defined causal order, or?
It's like we.
I'm just wondering how generic the setup is.
How generic? Like, if
even like a determining if it has even a causal order, is it something? I'm not familiar with these subjects, but I'm wondering, like, is it even easy to determine that there should exist a causal order, or?
We can see from later in our algorithm that if the algorithm fails, then there's no such
order. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay. So there has been some works on causal order detection. Some works focus on special cases of causal order discovery, such as two optical modes or two candidate paths. And there is a general algorithm based on the classical description of the process. However, in practice, classical description may be not easily obtained. To obtain it, we may need process tomography, which is inefficient. In our work, we're going to tackle with the general case. We'll use black box accesses, and we will have an efficient algorithm. And here are our results. We devise the first efficient algorithm for quantum causal order discovery. By efficient, we mean that the query complexity or number of black box access to C is polynomial in N. We have three algorithms. The first one deals with general causal orders. We use a quantum circuit to observe multiple systems simultaneously. Our algorithm is efficient for comms composed of fixed size unitary gates. And this corresponds to the case where we have unitary interactions with a fixed sized quantum system. The other two algorithms deal with special cases. They feature a much lower query complexity that could be as low as a log n. And they are also easier to implement because they use only local state preparation and local measurements. I'm going to talk about algorithm one in detail. Our algorithm is based on the following condition for quantum comm. If AX is the last input, then it can affect nothing except the last output. Formally, we have this proposition. Let C be the choice state of the channel C, curly C. If AXBY is the last tooth, then this equation holds true. In this equation, the left-hand side is a marginal state on all systems except BY. The right-hand side has two parts. The first is a marginal state on all systems except AX and BY. And the second part is IAX, meaning the identity operator on AX. These two terms has a tensor product form, meaning that these are independent, which is that AX is independent of everything before it. To check this condition, we convert this condition to checking whether a channel is a constant channel. The channel is built like this. We take the original channel C, we pick AX as an input, and for every other input, we feed it with a half a maximally entangled state. On the output side, we discard the output of BY and keep everything else. If AXBY is the last tooth, then AX affects nothing except the last output BY. And thus, this channel has input and output that are totally uncorrelated. So this channel will be a constant channel. To test whether a channel is a constant channel or not, we all use the swap test. The swap test is a quantum circuit that estimates the overlap between two quantum states. It has such a circuit structure. It's a controlled swap gate where the control qubit is initialized as a cat plus state. On the output side, it is measured later with the plus minus basis. And the probability of these outcomes will be related to the overlap between the states rho and sigma. Therefore, we can run this circuit many times and count the number of each outcome. From this, we can give an approximation of the overlap trace rho sigma. With this tool, we can build the test of a constant channel. To decide whether a channel is constant or not, we check whether the output is different on different inputs. The algorithm goes as follows. First, we pick a set of input states, psi alpha. This set needs to be informationally complete, meaning that every operator can be written as a linear combination of these states. Second, we apply the channel C on each of the input states and let rho alpha be the output. Three, we compare those outputs. Here we pick rho one as a pivot and we compare each rho alpha with rho one. The distance measure we use here is a Hilbert-Schmidt distance. We use this because it can be decomposed as the linear combination of overlaps between quantum states. And then these overlaps can be estimated with swap tests. And last, we decide C to be a constant channel if all distances are small. Now we have an algorithm to test whether channel is constant or not. And recall that the purpose of this test is actually to test whether a pair of input and output is the last tooth of the comm. Before I go to the main algorithm, I'm going to show our assumption. We assume that that comm C consists of unitary interactions with fixed-sized system, memory system. And the structure is shown in this figure. In this figure, the memory system is initialized as a pure state. And every tooth is a unitary gate. And at the last, the final memory state is discarded. We first assume that all dimensions of input and output wires are the same, and also the memory wire does not change. This structure does not really break the generality to express causal structures, because any quantum comm can be written as a concatenation of unitary gates as long as we pick a large DM. However, this assumption is important for our algorithm. Our assumption ensures that the comm has a low cross rank. This can be seen that from that each tooth is a unitary gate, and at last, only a DM dimensional system is traced out. Therefore, the whole channel has cross rank no larger than DM. Furthermore, if we ignore the last tooth, meaning that we feed the input with maximal mixed state and discard the output, the rest will be a n minus one tooth comm. And this new comm still satisfies assumption one and thus have rank no larger than DM. This is important for our algorithm because the efficiency of testing constant channels depends on the rank of the channel. And the cross rank is not growing ensures that during the execution of our algorithm, the efficiency can be ensured from start to end. Now we are able to present our main algorithm. The idea is to use recursion. Once we find the last tooth, we ignore it, and the rest will be an n minus one tooth comm. Then we recursively apply our algorithm on the n minus one tooth comm until we have only one tooth left. So the algorithm goes as follows. First, if C has only one tooth, then we output the tooth and exit. Otherwise, we go to step two and we enumerate all possible input-output pairs until we find a pair such that AXBY is the last tooth of this channel, of this comm. After this, we ignore AXBY and we recursively call our algorithm on the rest n minus one tooth comm. And last, we output XXBY. We are appending AXBY to the end of the outputs because this is the last tooth. The accuracy and efficiency of our algorithm is given in this theorem. Under our assumption with high probability, our algorithm outputs a causal order such that there exists a quantum comm D that is compatible with this causal order and that the distance between C and D is small. The distance is measured between as the trace distance between the choice states of C and D. Our algorithm is efficient in the sense that it runs polynomial in N. It has a query complexity polynomial in N, but it's also polynomial in DADM and the error epsilon zero. That's all for algorithm one. And now I'm going to talk about the other two algorithms, which deals with special cases. These two algorithms are based on a subroutine that computes the correlation matrix between all the inputs and outputs. This is a Boolean matrix in the IJ such that if in the IJ is true, then the input wire AI and the output wire BJ are approximately independent. This subroutine uses only local state preparation and local measurements, and it has a low query complexity as low as logarithmic in N. With this Boolean matrix and some proper assumptions, we can infer the causal structure. We solved some special cases, including when each input wire has a non-trivial correlation with every output wire after it, and when the COM is a tensor product of single system channels. To sum up, we have given the first efficient algorithm that discovers general quantum causal orders. This is important for quantum networks because we can use this to discover the data transmission paths or the trajectories of particles. As it can be also used as a verification technique. For quantum circuits, we can use our algorithm to check the input-output correlations. Additionally, we can also use our algorithm on quantum states to discover the latent structure of multi-party states. Knowing the latent structure is important for example, for efficient compression of them, just as what I presented in the first part of my talk, and also for efficient tomography of states. We have proposed three algorithms. Algorithm one deals with the general causal order, which is efficient for comps consisting of fixed size unitary gates. The other two algorithms deal with special cases. They are easier to implement since they use only local state preparation and local measurements. They are also more efficient. The query complexity is as low as logarithmic in N. Here are some future directions of this work. First, instead of the quantum COM, we may consider some other causal structure models for causal structure. For example, we can use a causal graph, which is a directed cyclic graph to describe the causal structure. To do this, we may need to improve our algorithm so that it can discover the causal structures with a better precision. Second, our algorithms do not really efficiently solve all possible cases. For example, for comps with an exponentially large memory, our algorithm one would be inefficient. However, we do not think this is a limitation of our theorem, of our algorithm, because it's the problem that is intrinsically difficult. Even for classical causal order discovery, the most generic case is difficult. To circumvent this problem, we may need a new problem formulation. A candidate would be the probabilistically approximately correct algorithm, or PAC algorithm. In this new formulation, we consider answer is correct as long as a limited power verifier cannot disprove it. This, the PAC is actually an idea from machine learning, and we expect to use this idea for quantum causal structure detection. Okay, and that's all for my talk. Thank you for listening, and questions are welcome.
Great, thank you for the excellent talk. Do we have questions?
Thank you.
I have a question.
Yeah, yes, please.
Hi, so about your algorithm for causal structure discovery. So I guess this is an idea inspired by Benny's question. So suppose we don't assume that there is this causal quantum comb structure. Suppose we want to deal with general multipartite quantum channels. It seems maybe your algorithm can be generalized a little bit, because now the assumption is that the last tooth has only one input and only one output that's open.
Yeah.
But in a more general case, you could have multiple inputs and multiple outputs.
Well, I'm thinking, is it different from if we consider those multiple inputs and outputs together?
It's not different. I guess it's up to you to group them together. So that's why I think the algorithm could be generalized.
Like, do you mean this algorithm could be generalized to, if we don't use a quantum COM formulation, we can use some other, like the causal graph? Do you mean this?
I guess, yes, it's generalized in the sense that you don't have to assume that your multipartite channel has a comb structure. but you can use the causal graph description, or you can have a generalized comb description.
Oh, yes, yes.
You know, the combs have multiple inputs and multiple outputs.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But we just use a comb structure to prove our things, to do our proofs. For the more general case, yes, we can do that, but we still need to work with those technical details.
It's not clear to me, you know. To me, the detail that needs to be worked on maybe is efficiency. But otherwise, it seems the algorithm just simply works because you can group these inputs together.
Yes. That's right. And actually, the efficient part is quite tricky.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for your question.
So I have a question. There's this literature on the complexity of identity testing where you have to test if a given circuit is the identity or not. So a given sequence of gates is the identity or not. And I wonder if, you know, is that related to your
constant channel testing,
or is that kind of a different setting? I don't know if you're familiar with the identity testing literature at all.
Well, that doesn't sound directly related. It's like the constant channel is quite a large, it's not restricted to identity. It's like the exact opposite of an identity channel. As identity channel has perfect correlation and this case has no correlation.
Okay,
thank you.
Can I ask another question? It's actually about the tensor network compression. I still want to get some insight on the algorithm, and you mentioned that you will use a universal quantum emulator. Am I?
Yes, yes.
Is it the one due to like Marvian and?
Marvian and Lloyd. Yes.
So it basically runs the unitary with with samples, right? And how do you use it?
It learns a unitary, and we just use that unitary to perform the compression. Because in our case, we are considering actually the exact compression. So the unitary we learn is the unitary that goes from the state space to the memory space. To do this, the only difficulty is to generate the learning samples. And after we have the samples, we can just tell the machine to do.
I see. I think I got the idea. So then another question is you mentioned that tensor network is like a directed graph, but in some cases we could interpret input of the tensor as like output. We can just rotate the tensor and then we can interpret tensor network in a way we want, right? So even like a causal structure is not like a priori obvious. So your like causal ordering thing, maybe it's useful for even like determining.
This is just for easier presentation. And tensor networks, we usually don't assign those directions.
Yes.
But it's just for better presentation because we need to connect the bras and cats and those things. So we use the things with direction.
Okay, that's all my question.
Thank you.
Do you have any more questions? If not, let's thank again for the great talk.
Okay, thank you again for listening and inviting me.
So I think this ends the formal part of the talk, but sometimes we stay a bit longer to chat, but I know it's late for you. So if you want to go, that's also totally fine.
Now, a few minutes is okay.
Okay, I'll just stop the recording.
Sure.